If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, this is Seth Meyers, and you're listening to the Late Night Podcast Summer Friday Edition.
Welcome to the second episode of the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast, Summer Friday, featuring all exclusive content just for the podcast. On today's show, a message from a very important new organization. Then, the Late Night writers settle a debate that's been tearing apart the writer's room. And finally, Late Night writers Alex Bates and Mike Scollins talk about what it's like writing comedy in today's day and age. It's the symbol of strength.
I always knew I wanted to make a difference in the world. And in outer space, too.
And only one Commander-in-Chief is finally doing what has to be done.
That would be the Space Force.
We'll call it the Space Force. Space Force.
I also always wondered if aliens existed. And if they did, the many, many ways I could kill them.
I want to see a spaceship.
I want to shoot an alien in his big, fat face.
I'm trying to fly at hyperspeed.
Kill those aliens.
Pew, pew, motherfuckers.
Before there was a nation, there had to be people willing to fight for it. And before that, there was space.
At some point in the future, we're going to look back and say, how did we do it without space?
They'll be better educated, better trained, and better equipped than any space force in history.
We are finally going to lead again. You see what's happening? You see the rockets going up left and right?
Rockets going in all directions.
If we don't get there first, the Chinese will take all the moon coal. And I'm not cool with that.
So follow in the footsteps of the heroes who came before you, like Matt Damon and Bruce Willis and Will Smith.
It's like Independence Day, but better.
Reach for the stars and enlist today. Because we are all Space Force Strong.
Hello, I'm Amber Ruffin, and welcome to the Late Night Podcast. On this segment, we are going to settle a debate that has been raging in our writer's room lately. I will be acting as the moderator, and joining me, arguing for their respective sides, are two of our writers, Mike Carnell and John Lutz.
Happy to be here, Amber.
I do not know why I am here. I should be home with my family right now.
We are all here, not with our loved ones, to settle something once and for all. What does the mascot of Little Caesars say at the end of the commercials? Mm-hmm. Lutz, you side with the majority of Americans in saying that is pizza, pizza.
Yep.
Carnell, you argued that the saying is actually piece of pizza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so just to be clear, we got in one argument 2 weeks ago, and he will not let it go, all right? He's even called my house a couple times this weekend.
It's because you won't admit that you're wrong.
You called at 5 a.m. on Saturday and woke my kids up.
Well, honestly, it's about time that their eyes were open to how wrong their father is.
Okay. All right. Amber, could we just please roll the commercial?
Please roll it. Please.
Pizza, pizza.
Okay. So I guess I rest my case.
Well, Carnell, I have to say that was pretty cut and dry.
Yeah, I'm with you. I definitely heard pizza, pizza.
Okay. The mascot is very clearly saying pizza, pizza.
The mascot. Amber, do you hear this? The mascot. Wow. He has a name, Lutz. First name Little, last name Caesar. Maybe if you showed him, I don't know, a little respect, You might start listening to what he has to say. Or is that beneath you because he's Italian?
What? Okay, I don't have anything against Italians.
Then start acting like it.
He's right. Tone it down, Lutz.
Okay, can I just please go home?
Permission to start my defense before he does.
You may proceed.
Thank you. I'm just going to pull up on my phone here a logo for Little Caesars, all right? For those of you at home, you Google Little Caesars logo and follow along. All right, guys, look closely at this logo, and you will see that he clearly has two large slices of pizza on his spear and is graciously offering us, the viewers, one of them.
It's pizza, pizza. There are two pizzas, and that is why he says pizza, pizza.
Why would he say pizza, pizza like some brain-dead Neanderthal? He's a Roman dignitary who has graced us with his presence and is offering a piece of...
Nope, don't say it.
Pizza.
It's not... No.
And if I may, what is pizza?
What?
Mozzarella? Pepperoni?
Mozzarella.
Mozzarella? How do you guys say it?
Mozzarella.
Have I been saying it wrong the whole time?
Yeah.
Permission to start the speech over.
Sure.
What?
Pizza, what is pizza? Mozzarella? Pepperoni? Dough? Yeah. If you said yes, you'd be wrong.
No.
Because that's just a circle topped with ingredients. It doesn't really become a pizza until you slice it.
That's not a thing.
And with four simple strokes of a blade, that pie becomes something more. It becomes something we can share with our wives, husbands, children, coworkers, friends, hell, even a stranger. It is that outstretched hand holding a perfect slice of Americana, typed with a little Parmesan, that brings people together. And at a time where our country feels as divided as ever, what better way to build a bridge with our neighbors than for Little Caesar to ask that simple, age-old question? Would you like a piece of pizza? Thank you.
No, Amber... Don't
Thank you for clapping.
Don't
I rest
clap,
my
Amber.
Case.
No.
I liked it because it was long.
I rest my case and move to fire this, Lutz for his severe and disturbing anti-Italian stance. Thank you again.
Do I get to have a rebuttal?
Well, you would have, but his was so long. Mm. Now, after hearing both sides' arguments, I'm going to side with Carnell on
what?
This. Little Caesar says, piece of
pizza.
Woo. Mm-hmm. Thank you for listening. And I think I speak for everyone when I say how thankful we are to put this issue behind us.
Pizza, pizza.
Hi, summer podcast listeners. My name is Alex Bays. I'm the head writer and a producer here at Late Night with Seth Meyers. And I'm here with Mike Scollins.
Hello, summer podcast. I'm Mike Scollins. I am a writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers.
And Mike is primarily, I'd say, a monologue writer, would you say?
I would say primarily a monologue writer.
Everybody does double duty, and almost everybody, between monologue and sketch and other stuff. So we have just, here's where we are in our workday. It's about 2:20. We just came out of the monologue read, which is where we take all the jokes that all of us have written, all the monologue jokes. It's probably about 400 jokes. And then I cut that packet about in half, throwing away the super obvious losers, duplicates, stuff with swear words in it, stuff that doesn't make any sense. And then we take that packet of about 200 into Seth, and we all sit around, and he reads them out loud as fast as humanly possible.
Very fast.
Although it used to bother me that he did that, and having known him now for 10 years, I'm like, oh, he is processing every word of this. He's just so much faster than I am. So he sits there with a highlighter and reads through our jokes while we cringe and feel bad. And he picks today seven out of the 200. And then we get back to work normally, but now we're just f***ing around and
but
doing
it's
a
summertime.
Podcast.
But so it's summer podcast instead.
Yeah.
So we got seven out of the 400 that you read?
Yeah. And you know, you'd need like 10 or 11 for a monologue, so it's not crazy. Now, we will take these to rehearsal in a little bit, and he will read them to an audience, and they will hate most of them.
Right.
So we'll cut them that way, because we compile a rehearsal audience, basically people who are in the building, usually in the NBC store. So people who are taking a tour of an office building.
Right, not actively seeking out any comedy.
No, not even really actively seeking out something interesting to do. They're just like, I want a Friends mug.
Actively seeking out a Friends mug.
Yes.
But then get brought into rehearsal to
Shanghai.
The fate of our jokes.
They get shanghaied.
Yeah, by one of the late night interns.
Yeah, and then we make them watch the stuff we wrote, and they are, you know, some of them try to figure out what kind of show is this? Is this a game show? Who is this man? Some of them are fans. I see a Late Night with Seth Meyers t-shirt once in a while. But I mean, we don't go strictly by how they react, but it's a good gauge.
Right. And it also shows us any holes that we have in the monologue. Sometimes we'll have, you know, if we need 10 or 11 jokes and 8 of them are about kind of evergreen subjects that would go towards the end of the monologue, that means that we're missing a couple of the big stories.
Yeah, we end up a little lopsided sometimes. Can you remember the last joke from rehearsal of yours that you swore up and down in your brain was going to go great and ate it? Or does it happen so often?
I know that I feel like I'm not going to have a good story because I've learned to not be remotely as precious about my jokes anymore because, like we just said, we were 400, now there's 7.
Yeah, that is like the first and hardest thing for young writers to learn when they get here. They're like, hey, I wrote 20 jokes and then you're only using one? I'm like, yeah, that's a good batting
good job.
Average. Good job. You got something on TV.
Yeah.
Plus, you got money. You got to eat a salad.
And you got paid for that.
You were indoors all day.
But it is crazy to think that like 96% of the jokes I write just live on my hard drive.
I always tell people when I interview them, just like everything you write is going into the shredder. Just think of it that way. And then like a magic hand comes and grabs something once in a while.
Yes.
Just think of it like that and you won't have agita. And yet it's very hard for people to get past.
Oh, yeah. And it's still... I mean, I've been here for like 2.5 years now, and it still sucks when you feel like you didn't have a great day, even though it is like the successes are short and the failures are short.
You've been here how long?
Same as you, right? 2.5 years?
I've been in this building doing this for 15 years.
Yeah.
And yeah, it still sucks.
It still sucks.
It sucks more when you swear up and down, this is brilliant, and Seth is like, I don't know.
Yep.
And the rehearsal audience is, no, we don't like that.
Yes.
And you're like, oh no, my internal meter is broken and I don't know how this works anymore. And I can't go into advertising now. They're not going to hire a 52-year-old man. And you go through a whole thing and then it's fine. And then the next day you're like, oh, I thought, yeah, here's a good one. And then you're fine.
But you go through that with Seth and the audience. I go through it with Seth, the audience, and you.
Oh, that's true. You get an extra layer. Oh, it's nice to be. That's like, I never thought about that. I'm on the other side of it from your point of view. I'm the monster under your bed.
Yeah, I still have a couple of them like, that didn't even get read out loud.
Ah, I like that. So I'm a man without a country. Oh, good. I'm living in Elysium and
but I also find myself
in the Hunger Games.
I self-edit quite a bit as well.
Yeah.
So I also cut a lot of my own jokes before I send them to you.
That is good to hear. And it's a good skill to develop. And that's kind of where I am with Seth now. I've worked with him for so long that a thing will pop into my head and my first thought is like, he'll hate it. And then my second thought is, I don't like it either.
Yeah.
So when I go into a joke read, everybody else has written 3 pages usually, 30 jokes or so, 25.
Right.
And I write 4 or 5 because I'm like, 3 of these are good.
Right.
Not always sure which 3, but I don't have time with the other constraints here to write 20 jokes. So
right.
I'm just like, here's 4 that I thought of. I thought of 50, and they stunk so fast that
here
I didn't have to type them.
Actually stand by. It's funny talking about mono joke writing because it's not very collaborative.
No.
I'll like, if I'm not sure like a take is right or if a specific is right, I'll like G-chat one of the other writers and be like, does this work for you?
Oh, that's nice. But, that's more than I got.
Or like, is this a joke that's been done or something like that? But aside from that, like until we go into Seth's too, I have no idea what anyone else is working on. And they don't know what I'm working on.
That's true. It's funny. I had that experience at SNL working on Weekend Update because their offices are on the same floor, but it's a separate office for Weekend Update.
Right.
So I never knew until like Friday what was in the show. And you would go see a rehearsal and go, oh, they're doing a sketch about that? Hmm. Well, that kills my joke about that.
Right.
So our writer's room, logistically, feels like a nightmare for a writer. It is one big open room with a lot of like semi-cubicles, I guess, stations. How can you think in there? What's your coping mechanism?
I absolutely love the layout, like, until I don't.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you know, I talk quite a bit in that office, but then when I'm like, can everyone just shut the hell up for a second? I mean, there is, people use Fred Armisen's office.
Oh, yeah. People sneak off to other places.
If they need to work alone. Headphones work great.
What's on your headphones? Are you playing music?
I don't use headphones.
Oh, you don't?
Okay. But like,
but if
Ian
everybody
Morgan,
else is, that's
Ian Morgan, our writer, listens to like sounds of the ocean while he writes jokes.
Wow. That explains a lot of his jokes.
They're all ocean themed.
Like, why does he think plankton is so funny? All right. Yeah, I have a separate office attached to the writer's room, and I still have, like, blinds on my door. I have a white noise machine that goes all day long, because the main reason is that Michelle Wolf used to work here, and she...
Did a white noise machine help with Michelle Wolf?
It took the corners off it a little bit.
But I think I can hear her right now.
She, not that she was talking, she just laughs a lot. She enjoys her work. She has a good time. But her laugh, it's like, can penetrate, I think, anything on the periodic table. I think they use her laugh in mining to loosen the ore. So I had to get a white noise machine.
You've been doing this for however many years,
15.
Including SNL 15, and that white noise machine was brought in because of Michelle
yes.
4 years ago?
Yeah. Most comedy writers sit quietly and type, and maybe they mutter to each other.
Right, right.
And then, you know, you get the black swan, the occasional outgoing comedy writer. And you're like, well, now I need to deal with this somehow. And it worked-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm very curious about her writer's room and her new show.
Yeah, I don't know what that layout is, but...
I know they're having fun.
I know they're having fun, and she is the boss. Should we talk about how you started? Are you sick of telling that story?
It's a long one. Well, I'll say this. I was a sketch writer. I was convinced I was a great sketch writer. I came through the Chicago improv scene in the 90s with like Andy Richter and all those guys, Brian Stack and Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and so on. And Adam McKay got hired to SNL, and that was like everyone's heads jerked upwards. And we were like, wait, there's jobs. We can do this for money. And so with his help, got in an interview at SNL with my sketch packet. And they were like, oh, great. You did really well. You came in fourth out of the people we interviewed. We're going to hire three people. So... good try. If you want to, you can fax jokes to Weekend Update to like keep your name in the mix. And I was like, okay, great. I don't know how to do that. I've never written a monologue joke. I love them. And I loved watching stand-up and I watched Weekend Update every week. And I was like, but I don't know how they do it. It was like watching a magician to me. I was like, oh, that was great. Don't know how they did it. So I had to like just watch. I mostly watched Tina because it was Tina and Jimmy, I think, at the time. And Jimmy could do a lot of voices, but Tina was like the structure had to be in place.
Right.
Jimmy had a lot of moves when she worked with Amy. Amy had a lot of moves, but Tina was like, I just got to read this with the right inflection. That's all I'm going to do. And so I just would try to reverse engineer every joke. I would watch an update, you know, get all her jokes written down and just go, all right, how does it work? Just like take it apart like a tweaker with a CD player. Just like, how, what's making this go, and just try to puzzle it out. And so I submitted jokes via email. They call it faxing because nothing ever changes up there,
right?
In terms of nomenclature. But I did that for 6 years, and submitting a packet every year, trying to get hired every year. No thanks. By the sixth year, I had a joke on every week the whole season as a faxer, which is crazy. And then at the end of that season, I was like, nothing happened. And I said, all right, screw it. I'm not sending another packet. I just like, I'm going to go to this wedding in Scotland that I have to go to.
Right.
And so they called me while I was at this wedding, and they were like, hey, where's your packet? We have an opening. And I was like, oh,
still a sketch packet at this point.
Well, it's the whole thing. You send sketches and jokes, but they were like, hey, we're looking for your packet. And I was like, oh, I didn't send one. And they're like, well, come on down and get interviewed. And that's how I got hired. So it's like, it took a very long walk to get there.
Did you know you were interviewing for Update, or did you think it was
sketch? Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. At that point, yes. Because you were occasionally in touch with somebody.
Right.
And it's, you know, once they think of you for one thing, it's true across the business, I guess. It's like, you're the person who does X.
Right, right.
It's so hard to be the person who does X and Y. And so they're like, oh, we have a Y person. We need X. Like, all right. Yeah, so it was an update for 10 years, became the producer there, and then Seth got this show and invited me over. And it was the right time, because I didn't want to be a weird old ghost roaming the halls at SNL.
So was this show the first time you had ownership over sketch as well?
Because
you're not just head writer for monologue. You're
well, at Update, you had some ownership over the features.
Feature pieces,
not
right.
really ownership, but, you know, editors, rights. You could just basically go, this is 5 minutes long. It needs to be 3:38.
Uh-huh.
I would kill this and this, you know, some of that. And you would occasionally write a feature or work on a feature, but it was mostly about having the jokes in place because the rest of the staff would take care of the features pretty well.
Right.
And, you know, we had our little office down the hall, so we were never in touch with anybody. So I would go to Bill Hader and go, hey, I got an idea for a feature. And he'd be like, oh, and you are? Oh, right. I saw you at the party. But yeah, I mean, it's a great boot camp that serves people well. The whole industry is just flooded with people who came through SNL.
Right.
Did you ever apply? You must. Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Because I think I read your packet at SNL and we're like, oh, pretty good. We're not hiring. But.
Yeah, I guest wrote at SNL.
Right.
And when they brought me in the spring, they said we loved your packet in the fall, but we didn't hire any packet writers. I guess the writers that they had hired were performers.
Friends.
That, yeah.
Friends of ours.
But I was already doing Faxless for Update when I got brought in to guest write as a sketch writer.
Gotcha.
My very first Faxless submission was Colin's first show.
Okay.
And I got a joke on my first time, which felt amazing, but also set up an unrealistic expectation of like, oh you
yeah.
just like submit your packet of 10 jokes and then one of those jokes gets on or something. And I did have like, you know, more success than other people that were submitting over fax, I believe. But I was like, oh, I just like knocked it out of the park my first time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's not traditionally what happens. But then when I got brought into guest write, they had me doing sketch and also a little bit of Update for a couple weeks.
Yeah, you didn't come up as a straight up joke writer, right? You were a performer and still are?
Yeah, the Upright Citizens Brigade is mostly a sketch writer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no real world out there until you get a TV job.
Right.
Like this kind of joke writing, like this happened in the news.
Exactly.
Here is my take. There's definitely, I mean, stand-ups, but I'm amazed how many stand-ups will get a job like this and they can't do it. And they're like, oh, this isn't.
Well, the structure is very different.
It is, right? Because there's very little topic. Like you're doing pieces when you do stand-up. You're doing bits and chunks.
Right.
And here it's like full stop, two sentences to a punchline, and then full stop again.
Right.
New topic.
Almost like, it works almost like a math problem or something.
It really does.
Where
what's how do you look at a setup? What's your first, you're like, all right, we need a joke about Trump pulled out of the North Korea summit. You look at the setup and
I look at the setup and
how do you start to take it apart?
The first thing I try to think about is connections. And then the second thing I try to think about is if there's like an interesting word or phrase in the setup.
Oh, yeah.
Even if I don't necessarily have a joke for that right away, it makes me think like the audience is going to expect a joke on this phrase because that's what everyone's hearing
that's
right now
stick
from
to
the
their brain a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That you almost like feels like you don't get to choose. Like it's got to be something about
right
that.
Yeah, there are occasions where you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Everybody's going to, yeah, you have to latch onto that thing. Sometimes I'll rewrite a setup if that happens.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Because
you're
just like, oh, I don't want to write about the weird phrasing of that setup.
Right, like if it's had, there was one today that had appetite in the setup. And I was like,
oh, yeah.
Well, a food joke's just going to be too expected.
Yeah.
Because the audience is going to hear the word appetite. So that's like a setup that you would rewrite.
You might, or and if
or
you
have
were
a
like
great food jokes,
six of our writers, you would just write a food joke. And you know, there's no reason you can't write a food joke that would work, but
right,
you have to be aware that they're going to see it coming and
exactly
cook up.
Oh, there we go.
Oh my God,
cracked it right.
I even do it by accident, you guys.
This is great because this is time I would be writing jokes.
Yes, both of us. We have a perfect excuse. Now we're creating content. We put together like 20 minutes for you.
It just becomes our process
it's
now.
It's just going to be a weird podcast that our moms will hear.
Maybe.
Your mom will hear.
My mom will hear. Should we look at this list of topics?
Yeah, man.
Ask
me anything.
This is a good one for you. How has writing comedy for TV and beyond changed over time?
How has it changed over time? Well, it changed when Trump got elected. Everything changed.
Yes.
Because we went from being a decaying democracy to a former
broken
democracy,
one, yeah.
I think. But everything sort of jacked into a state of constant emergency. And you're aware that the audience is now mentally in a different place. Especially the physical audience. I'm not so much the TV audience at home, but the audiences that come in here are people who live on the East Coast and are educated and are tend to be more liberal than most.
Right.
And they're fretting already.
Right.
And you haven't even told them that Trump pulled out of the summit yet. So there's already, you're like, oh, I have an extra job where I have to take that into account first. There's stuff you can't ignore anymore.
Right.
It used to be, and stories used to last for like a week, like something like this would be a month-long story, Trump pulling out of the summit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if Obama had pulled out of some summit, they would talk about it for 3 or 4 weeks because nothing else would really be happening.
Right. This won't be the story when we come back.
I remember there was a time when, like, the debt ceiling discussion was going on, and we had to write jokes about it for like 2 months because there just wasn't another story.
Right.
It's like, oh, Michelle planted a vegetable garden. So we just wrote jokes about that for a week.
Thank God Obama asked for fancy mustard.
Yeah, where we wore a tan suit. I'm like, oh, great. Thank God. And now it's like Trump pulled out of the summit. We wrote jokes about it all morning. And then something will happen this afternoon. It may be happening right now because we're not looking at a TV. We'll walk out there
what
and be like,
what horrors are we going to lead to once this podcast
Rudy Giuliani
is over.
Took his shirt off on Fox News. We'll have to do something about that. And then, you know, by the time the show airs, we're like, oh, no, it's Pence is president now.
Is that the fun stuff for you about this show or the stressful stuff when news breaks at 5:45 and we're taping at 6:30?
Yes, it is. It's extremely stressful when it happens, but it's a little portal to an opportunity for us as a show. You want people to come to the show thinking, I can't wait to see what they have to say about that thing.
Right.
Instead of coming to the show and going, there's so much going on, I don't even know what they're going to talk about.
Right.
When there's one big thing that happens in a day, it's great. It's panic around here in terms of like getting stuff to cue cards and figuring out what to write about it. And do we need graphics for this? It's chaos. And then you know, it's a math problem. And then you all get to solve it together, ideally. Then you get to go watch the show with the audience and watch Seth pull it off. And
right.
It's like, oh, great.
Feels great.
This is great.
Yeah.
Please, nothing else happen. And sometimes you luck out and nothing else happens.
Right.
What makes a good, fun day in there? A Chipotle setup?
Oh, God.
Oh, good times.
Today
is asparagus day.
Today is asparagus day, and you're going to need to like, make your pee smell. That's fun.
Yeah.
You love these stories. I like when news breaks late.
Yeah.
You know, it probably helps that I'm not head writer. And
no, I love it
and
too.
And you have different stresses than I do, but I kind of like the action of like, yeah, let's pull something together in the next 20 minutes.
Right.
That's fun for me.
Yeah, it's
great. And if you can like pull off a great joke in those 20 minutes, you're like, yeah, that feels great.
You do want the audience to go, how the did they do that?
Yeah,
oh
yeah,
my
yeah.
God, great. Instead of like, he is kind of fat.
Right, well, they reference what happened.
Oh, appetite.
That's not to say there aren't times I wish the news would slow down, obviously.
Yeah, for personal reasons. Yeah. And it will again, I think. If we're both at this show long enough, I mean, this administration will go away, I think.
Obama will be president again.
Comedy will be illegal. So one way or another, everything will change for us. But yeah, somebody boring and procedural will come, and then we'll have a whole new set of challenges.
Yeah,
it will be like we were pot smokers for a long time, then we had like 2 years of doing coke every day, and then we'll be trying to go back to pot. We're like, I don't know if we can do this.
How to do this anymore?
not getting that rush.
Yeah.
Worth it. We'll live longer.
Though. Yeah, that's true.
Mike Scollins, what a pleasure it's been
Alex
talking
Bays.
To you.
This has been such a treat.
This is the first chance we've had to meet.
This is also my performance review, so this is going to be another 45 minutes.
Doing great. Please send in Seth Reese. All right, I guess we should wrap it. We're going to wrap it. All summer right. podcast
summer
audience.
Summer podcast.
Mike's mom, thanks for listening.
Bays' mom, you're probably not going to hear this.
Yeah, that's true. Can you say that in Italian?
Absolutely not.
All right, let's type jokes.
All right, goodbye.
Hey, everybody, we love books. We love authors on Late Night. And in that spirit, here are some summer reading recommendations from our guests.
Hi, this is Zach Woods, and I strongly recommend James Baldwin's short story, Sonny's Blues. Now, you're probably thinking this is like an obnoxious deep cut, like, oh, James Baldwin, short story, we get it. You have literary affectations. But the truth is, it's such a good story. It's so big-hearted and moving, and it's my favorite thing I've ever read. So I recommend it. Sonny's Blues.
Hi, this is Rakesh Sathyal, author of No One Can Pronounce My Name, just out in paperback from Picador, USA, and only $2.99 in ebook for the entirety of June, which is Pride Month. The book I'd like to recommend this summer is I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyoncé by Michael Arsenault. Now, this is a bit of a cheat because I am Michael's editor, but I just have to mention it because it's so darn good. Michael grew up gay and African-American in Houston, then went to Howard University before becoming a beloved journalist and cultural critic in New York. His voice is singularly hilarious, perceptive, and wise, and I think that this book is the cool must-read for 2018. It's out July 24th from Atria Books. Hope you'll pick it up. Thanks.
This is George Saunders, author most recently of Lincoln and the Bardo, and I'm recommending a strange and beautiful and in its time, I think, controversial novel by Gregor von Rosori called Memoir of an Anti-Semite. I read this for the first time a few weeks ago on a plane, and it just kind of blew my mind open, especially in this weird time we're living through right now, for the way it took on the question of how evil actually gets done in the world. It's not really a memoir, of course, but it's a novel in the form of a mock memoir written by a guy who's kind of a casual, if there is such a thing, a casual anti-Semite. He knows this about himself, doesn't really resist it, doesn't think much about it. He's interested in other things. But this is in pre-war Germany, so, of course, it has real consequences. I read the New York Review of Books edition, which includes a really wonderful intro by another genius writer, Deborah Eisenberg. And in there, she asks this question. How many actually evil people does it take to accomplish a genocide and reduce much of a continent to ash? Only a handful, it seems, but that handful requires the passive assistance of many, many other people who glance out of the windows of their secure homes and see a cloudless sky. It's easy enough for most of us to distance ourselves from attitudes of virulent racism, but what about from carelessness, poor logic, casual snobbery, either social or intellectual, inattentiveness? Rosori reminds us painfully that the great and malignant hazard of privilege is obtuseness. Now, this book gave me kind of a new way to think about our current politics. The notion that a harmful mass movement can be powered by lots of people who don't care all that much about the hurtful ideas the movement is espousing. And it's this micro not caring that allows otherwise good people to participate. So, a happy little summer read, but I do hope you all have a happy summer.
Thanks for listening to the Late Night Podcast. Late Night will be back on the air on Monday.
If you like what you hear, tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they listen to podcasts. And be sure to check out Late Night with Seth Meyers on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus. Explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries, and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.